Welcome to Elevate, the podcast where trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravapudi talk about the real issues that come with the fight for justice. So let's find inspiration in the wins. Let's learn from the losses. But most of all, let's keep learning and getting better and keep getting back in the ring. Are you ready to elevate your own trial practice, law firm, and life? Let's get started. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Hey, it's Ben. Raul and I started this podcast because we love hanging out with fellow trial lawyers and sharing ideas that can make us all better. And both of our firms also regularly collaborate with other lawyers across the countries in cases where we can add value. If you're interested in collaboration, or even if you just have a case or an idea that you want to bounce off us or brainstorm, Raul and I are going to be hosting confidential case workshops the first Wednesday of each month. So here's how it works. If you have a case or an idea that you want to talk about or brainstorm with us, just send me an email to ben@elevate.net, E-L-A-W-V-A-T-E.net, or go online to elevate.net and submit a case workshop request. We will schedule you for a confidential 30-minute Zoom meeting where we can talk about your case to see if we can help. If you feel like there would be good value in collaborating on the case further, we can talk about that. If not, that's okay too. We enjoy helping other trial lawyers because we know someday you'd be willing to do the same for us if we needed your help. So again, if you're interested in workshopping your case with us, just send an email to ben@elevate.net or fill out a case workshop request at elevate.net, and Rahul and I will look forward to chatting with you soon. Today's episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by Filevine. Filevine has a software program called Lead Docket, which is the gold standard for managing your new case intakes and leads, your Glengarry leads, your Glenn Ross leads, and all of your other leads. So check them out at Filevine and manage your leads. We're also brought to you by Steno. Rahul, you guys work with Steno.
Steno is the best in court reporting services, not just in court reporting services, but even some of their technology tools. We're talking about AI a little bit on this podcast and their transcript genius, where they can summarize and take interrogatories based on deposition transcripts, is so useful. If you haven't tried it, definitely try it.
We're brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal does digital marketing, web development for trial firms. It's owned by our good friends, Micah and Tyler. They recently redeveloped our firm's website, so you can check our website out. If you like it, give them a call and they can help you out too. And finally, we're brought to you by Expert Institute. Rahul, you guys work with them, right?
We both use Expert Institute because you always need to be cutting edge in the experts that we use in our cases. Going to the repeat experts every single time is going to make you a lesser lawyer. And you always want to keep up. And the best way to do that is with Expert Institute. Welcome to the Elevate podcast. I'm Rahul Ravapudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon. Hey, Rahul, before we jump into things, what's going on with Buffalo Bills Nation here? I'm starting to worry about you. Our Patriots are already eclipsing you in the NFC East.
Your fall from grace was very short-lived. You're not even in the AFC East. You're leading the entire AFC conference right now. Enjoy it for the next 15 years that you get to enjoy it again, or however long it is. I had my moment in the sun, not winning a Super Bowl with the Bills. This is just, you know, it's the story of our lives, but I don't know what's going to happen. The season's not over yet, but I'm starting to feel some cracks in the dam.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? It's all bets are off this year, so we'll see what happens. I don't want to get too ahead of myself.
You look like you're ahead of yourself already. That's the look of somebody who's ahead of himself. That's amazing.
I'm ahead of myself.
Well, you know, I'm just going to say that with the Bills season in flux, I decided to go with my second passion, and I decided today to wear what I'm going to eat. I've got my McRib shirt on, so I am so excited. The McRib is back in town. That's where I'm going to go right as soon as we finish this podcast.
This episode of the Elevate podcast is brought to you by McRib. Now at limited time, the McDonald's and Los Angeles, La Cañada near you. You know, I've never had a McRib.
Come on. Come on.
No,
just don't watch a video about how they're made and then just go have one. If you watch the video, you never will.
You're going to treat the whole family or you're just picking it out on yourself?
I mean, if you want to go big, you know, but Child Protective Services could get called if you treat the whole family. So you should just do it to yourself.
How did you come into that McRib shirt? Did you buy it yourself or is that a gift?
It was a gift.
From someone who cares a lot about you.
Yes. Yes to both. It was a gift and I love it. And I wear it only on special occasions like today.
I've got a Budweiser t-shirt that I wear quite a bit. My daughter got it for me last year for Christmas, which is a questionable gift because, I mean, I do drink beer, but I don't think I've drank a Budweiser her entire life. And every time I wear the shirt, I say the same line. I go up to her and I say, you know how you know your daughter really loves you? And she's like, I know, Dad. She gets you a Budweiser t-shirt. I was like, yeah, that's it.
Budweiser was the one with the commercial, the what's up, right? Or was that something else? Bud Light?
It probably was.
You remember those? They're so good.
I don't, actually. I don't know how I would have missed that. It seems like something I'd know.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to send you a clip of that. But professional negligence is what I'm going to do to myself when I have this McRib later today, but it's a perfect segue into the amazing verdict you and Merrill got in Maine, the largest med mal verdict in Maine ever for a very deserving family who lost their daughter, Jazzy Vincent. And I have the privilege now of getting to talk to you guys about it and learn a lot from both of you, Merrill and Ben, about how you do things and how you were able to accomplish full justice for your client. So I'm going to be peppering you with questions, but first, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the facts of the case?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, Rahul, we represented mom and daughter. Mom is Lindsay and her 15-year-old daughter, Jazzy Vincent. In the summer of 2021, in about the middle of July, Jazzy ended up getting sick with some cough and shortness of breath. Her primary care provider had diagnosed her with pneumonia. And then shortly after that, Jazzy developed a set of very unusual symptoms. She developed swollen, enlarged, engorged breasts that had also enlarged veins and were black and blue and stiff and very, very painful. And Jazzy's mom called the primary care doctor to report the symptoms. And the primary care doctor said, you should go see a gynecologist. So Jazzy was able to get in that same day and see a gynecologist who was the provider that we tried the case against. And the provider did not perform even basic vitals for Jazzy, did not, although had obtained medical records from the primary care office, did not review any of those medical records before seeing Jazzy. And in the visit itself, after the visit, the gynecologist diagnosed Jazzy with basically a reaction to medication she'd been put on for the pneumonia, reaction to steroid medication. And the diagnosis was one, it was called gynecomastia. And gynecomastia is basically a benign growth of breast tissue, but in men and boys. It's not associated with prednisone use, and it is not a diagnosis for teenage girls. But the gynecologist diagnosed Jazzy with that condition and sent her home. And over the next 4 days, Jazzy wasn't getting any better. Mom was calling the primary care doctor, trying to report that Jazzy wasn't feeling any better. But by the fifth day, Mom decided to take Jazzy to the emergency department, where it was finally revealed that Jazzy had fluid building up around her heart and her lungs. And within a matter of hours, despite significant effort by the hospital, Jazzy went into cardiac arrest and passed away just a couple weeks shy of her 16th birthday. We made the case against the gynecologist very simple, which was Jazzy had an unusual constellation of symptoms when she presented there, highly unusual. And really what the gynecologist needed to do among performing a full set of vital signs and reviewing the history was just sending Jazzy for a basic chest x-ray. She's got all of these unusual chest symptoms, just got to look inside and investigate. And that simple step wasn't taken. And we argued that that was a significant contributing factor in bringing about Jazzy's death 5 days later.
So just a couple of questions on this. So when the gynecologist sees her, doesn't do any vitals, doesn't look at any medical records, and then reaches this diagnosis, which is only meant for males and not for teenage girls, how did the gynecologist get from point A to Z with that type of diagnosis? And then the second question is there, other than the chest x-ray, is there any type of objective test that can be done to diagnose gynecomastia or mastica?
Gynecomastia.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there's the story that she wanted to tell in the courtroom, and then there's the reality of maybe what actually happened about it. I think that, you know, basically her testimony and the best spin she could try to put on that was that I was only seeing this patient for breast-related symptoms because the other conditions, the pneumonia, the respiratory-related symptoms, those were already being handled by the primary care. And so with respect to the breast symptoms, you know, and this is her version of it, that these unusual set of symptoms came on temporarily at the same time she started the treatment for her pneumonia, which included a couple of medications, antibiotics, and prednisone. And apparently she had heard about at some point in the past that there could be a reaction to prednisone that might cause something like this. In fact, her note described discussing quote-unquote rare case reports. And so that was kind of in her mind. And so she settled on that as maybe the best explanation for what was going on.
So the gynecologist said, well, I'm only here for this one specialized issue involving the breast tissue, but didn't review any of the medical records and didn't even see what the assessment was by the primary care physician. How did that play out and how did you address it? Just on its face seems like a really bad defense.
Yeah, I mean, just to back up and give you the context for it, because I think it's helpful for the listener to hear it. So originally we had two defendants in the case. We had the primary care doctors and business, and we had the gynecologist. The primary care had seen our client on a couple of occasions for what was putatively diagnosed as pneumonia in the lead up to the visit to the gynecology practice. And then there were a number of phone calls between mom and, as Meryl alluded to, and primary care after the visit with the gynecologist. That case against the primary care had already resolved before trial. So we were trying the case against just the gynecology practice. We had done a big data study earlier on where both parties were in the case, and the data study revealed that the case, at least according to the data, the case against the primary care was much stronger than the case against the gynecology. I think principally because the gynecologist's argument in the data study that we presented was essentially, I only saw this patient once. I only saw this patient for one isolated issue. The patient was already under the care of another doctor for the other set of circumstances, and then the patient went back to the care of the other doctor afterward. So, I mean, I don't remember exactly what the numbers were, but we had something like a 33% win rate in our data study against the gynecology practice. So, and Meryl and my partner, Taylor, had done great work on the case and litigated this case for the better part of, I don't know, 3 to 4 years. When I got involved toward the end and we had narrowed the case to just the gynecology practice, what we realized is we really had to fundamentally change the approach to the case compared to how we were approaching it in the data study, or we were going to obviously lose. I mean, we need to win 2/3 of the jurors in a main jury, and we were losing 2/3 of them in the data study. So like Meryl said, we really tried to simplify the case against the gynecology practice and to focus all of our attention like a laser on that one visit and what happened in that visit. And to the extent the primary care was part of that story, to only make that tangential to the acts of the gynecology practice and as supporting points to the arguments we were making. So back to your question. So one of the issues about the failure to review medical records, that's the kind of thing that if you do medical malpractice cases, you like an issue like that because it doesn't require the jury to understand anything about medicine. It's just doing your job. It's just being thorough. It's treating a patient like a professional should in a serious matter, right? It'd be like giving your opinion about a case without reviewing the client's case files, or telling somebody, you know, what's wrong with their car without looking under the hood. And it's easy for jurors to understand that. This case, that argument was really bolstered by the fact that when the gynecologist learned that she was going to be seeing this patient who she had never seen before in her practice, her first instinct was to say, this patient shouldn't come to me to see me. She should go back to the primary care because she's already under their care for the pneumonia. And clearly what her thinking was is that this new constellation of highly unusual symptoms involving the breast and the chest and the blood vessels probably bore some relationship to the disease process that was going on with this child. And that was the correct instinct. Now, it turned out the PCP couldn't get her back into the office. And so when the gynecology's office called and was told the PCP can't get her in, they agreed to see her. And at that point, the gynecologist, again, did exactly the right thing. She asked her staff to get the recent medical records from this patient's treatment with the primary care so she would understand the history of what was going on with this 15-year-old with presumptive pneumonia. And the gynecologist, though, testified in her deposition and consistently throughout that despite requesting those records, and there was a paper trail showing that her nurse had reached out to the primary care immediately, requested the records be provided stat, which means immediately. And despite that, the gynecologist never reviewed the records. And so their original position was, well, we had asked for them to be faxed over, but they were never faxed over to us. But we were able to develop through an audit trail and through a 30B6 witness from the primary care that in fact they were faxed over within 5 minutes of the request. But somewhere between the fax machine and the gynecologists, they were misplaced or lost. So she never got them. And so it ended up just being a very simple argument that any reasonable office doesn't lose the patient's record. And if the gynecologist believes it's important to review the records, which she clearly did by asking for them to be faxed over stat, and she doesn't get them, she needs to ask somebody, where are they? And if they don't have them, to reach out again and get them faxed over again. I think it's very easy for somebody to understand that. What's interesting at trial is that the way they defended that, I think, ended up polarizing the case more, because rather than acknowledging that she should have reviewed the records and, you know, it was a mistake for them to be lost somewhere in their office, the gynecologist testified that, well, I didn't really need them anyway, because I got all the history I needed directly from the child and her mother. But if you look at the history she recorded, it missed probably 80% of the critical points that were extant in the record. It didn't have any of the vital signs. It didn't list what tests had been run or what weren't run. So for instance, she was diagnosed with pneumonia. You'd assume they had already run a chest x-ray that is positive and confirmed the pneumonia. But in fact, they hadn't ever run a chest x-ray. So she didn't know that because she didn't review the records. Now, she was hypoxic at the last visit, and there was a specific note that it was critical to monitor her vital signs carefully. They didn't take any vital signs at the gynecology office. They didn't know about the hypoxia or the note to monitor carefully because they didn't review the records. So we were able to connect the dots there to that simple failure to review records. That was one way we really simplified the case against the gynecologist. There were a couple of things that we did, but that was a part of it.
So was part of their defense that even if the gynecologist did what you suggested she should have done, order a CT, it all would have gone back to the primary care physician to deal with it, and whether they did it or didn't is all on them?
Yes, Rahul, that's exactly what they argued at trial.
One of the interesting challenges in our case was just how to present our client, because Lindsay Sutherland, who is Jasmine Vincent's mother, I mean, Meryl had a long relationship with her and representing her for a number of years, but I think it's fair to say she was a very strong personality, and finding a way to present her in a way where she wasn't going to end up being her worst enemy, and the good parts of her personality and her love and commitment to her daughter would shine through, that was a real challenge in terms of how we were going to do that. That we filed a bunch of motions in limine because there was a lot of quote unquote dirt that was out there in the internet, on social media, some with state regulatory agencies. And most of our motions were granted. So the defense was limited in what they could have done with that. However, there was still lots of dangers there in terms of what could happen if we overreached with her. So Merrill had the very large task of preparing Lindsay for her testimony at trial and presenting her. So you want to talk about that, Merrill?
Yeah. So as Ben said, when we began representing Lindsay way back in the fall, I think, of 2021, so just a few months after her daughter had passed, when she came to us, she was, of course, very, very raw, very distrusting. And that was a challenge. I mean, that was a challenge all throughout, and it was going to continue to be a challenge at trial. But as Ben said, you know, we wanted to try to find a way to present Mom, and of course, to present evidence about who Jazzy was in an accurate way, but without, number one, opening ourselves up or opening Mom up to attack somehow, or number two, not giving Jazzy's life the justice and credit that it deserved. One of the ways that we came up with for how to present Mom's testimony, so the objective being we need Mom to testify about the timeline of events and how she remembers things happening. And we also need Mom to testify about her loss and about her daughter and her life and her suffering. Having Mom testify about the timeline, actually, Ben came to me during the trial prep process and he said, we have these recordings of these phone calls between Mom and the primary care office for these for a couple days before she goes to the gynecologist, and then several phone calls in the days after she goes to the gynecologist. He said, we should play all of them, because if you listen to them, although none of them reflect Mom's conversations with the gynecologist, they all reflect just how much Mom was trying at the time. So we weren't going to have Mom sit there and say, I did this and I did this and I was thinking this and I was thinking that. The recordings just spoke for themselves. We must have played maybe 45 minutes worth of recordings all in all throughout Mom's testimony. But you can hear call after call after call, Mom being very, very detailed in reporting her daughter's symptoms, proactively raising concerns that she had. And by the way, this is a woman without any medical training. Mom graduated high school and had a little bit of college and did an EMT course at one point, but has no background in medicine whatsoever. But you can hear her going through very specific concerns. She's very patient, being bounced around to first an assistant and then a nurse. And she's just calling and calling and calling and being very reasonable. You know, she's not trying to be alarmist, but she is trying to convey her daughter's concerns. And I think at the end of the day, all of those calls demonstrating just how much Mom was caring and trying to be thoughtful and diligent and proactive really were a stark contrast with the providers, the medical providers, and what the medical providers were doing, specifically the gynecologist, and what they weren't doing, which I think was very helpful. So we have Mom twisting herself into knots, trying to do something, and we have a gynecologist who isn't reviewing medical records, isn't performing full sets of vital signs, is coming up with a very rare diagnosis and just sending the child home. It was a helpful contrast.
That's an amazing trial strategy and technique to employ to probably the most compelling and effective testimony out of a grieving mom. So just for the listeners, can you kind of walk us through sort of a little segment of how you used a particular audio recording and the questions before and after?
Yeah, I tried to keep the questions between very short and really just questions that were designed to continue advancing the ball through the timeline. So I started her direct by having her talk about Jazzy, and I wanted to get some of that out first. First, to establish, most importantly, that Jazzy was a happy, healthy, strong, vibrant child before any of this. And so we were able to establish that first. And then we transitioned into talking about mom's recollection of her daughter getting sick in the middle of July of 2021. And I started there and starting with, what did you do, mom? And she said, well, I called the primary care doctor. And you remember that call with the primary care doctor? Yes, I do. So why don't we play it? Move it into evidence and play it. And I just did that over and over again, walking through the timeline of events. And in between calls, I just fill in a little bit in the timeline. For example, there, Jazzy, shortly after she initially got sick with the respiratory symptoms, she went to a cheerleading camp. So this is a strong child who was really active and healthy. I wanted mom to testify about that. But as time goes on, you could hear mom getting more and more concerned in the calls, but the questioning in between was very minimal. So we had almost a straight 45-minute section of just listening to mom in real time, talking about showing the jury exactly what she was doing and what she was thinking, instead of having her sit there and say, this is what I did.
Amazing.
It was really powerful also because, I mean, the jury already knows, you know, for instance, as we get closer to the end of the timeline, the jury knows, for instance, with that last call that 24 hours later, her daughter would be dead and she's on the phone. You can tell she's, you know, she'd like to get her daughter seen. The primary care is saying, we have an opening this afternoon. You could bring her into the office, or if you prefer, you know, you could bring her to the emergency department. Maybe she needs some hydration. But there was no sense on anyone's part that there was any medical emergency, that there was anything other than kind of, you know, routine problem that could be addressed immediately, but, you know, wasn't a absolute emergency and not even necessarily an urgency. And just the idea. So there was some in the data study, I think one of the issues we faced is that some of the jurors were critical that mom didn't bring her in soon enough. Because of course, there's a lot of negative attribution bias, particularly against a mom. I've learned that over the years in doing these cases, that there's nobody held to a higher standard than mom. Mom is essentially held to, I think, a strict liability standard, that if you just have an absolute duty to do everything humanly possible to protect your child, even if nobody else would have done that in the moment, but in retrospect, when you're evaluating it, you're going to hold mom to that standard. But when you listen to those phone calls, you'd be really hard-pressed to think that any mom could have done more or better than this mom did. And I think that really helped a lot to take that issue off the table for us. And then despite our concern that, you know, mom did have some skeletons or that there could be some damage done on cross, after that direct, it was so effective that the defense lawyer essentially didn't cross-examine her. I think he asked 1 to 2 questions and then just sat down.
Take your playbook to the next level by joining a legal network of all-stars at psrplaybook.com. PSRPlaybook.com is a free digital legal library created exclusively for plaintiff lawyers by the nationally recognized personal injury law firm of Panish Shea Ravipudi LLP, and features video content showcasing the tactics, strategies, and concepts implemented by some of the industry's most successful trial attorneys. PSRPlaybook.com promotes learning, shared knowledge, collaboration, and best practices. Get in the game and see for yourself by joining our national network of plaintiff lawyers. Subscribe now at psrplaybook.com and learn from the best.
What were some of the motions in limine that you successfully brought and kept out relating to Lindsay?
There was an allegation that she had struck her daughter, and that had been referred to the Maine Department of Health and Human Services. And so we moved to keep that administrative investigation out of evidence. The court agreed with that. However, the court did rule that they could ask her whether she had ever struck her daughter or not. They elected not to do that. I think the striking the daughter thing was somewhat of a non-issue. It was a fairly benign thing that, you know, involved a slap and then some overreaction, and it spiraled out of control, but still that could potentially not go over well in front of a jury. There was also, mom has a somewhat estranged relationship with her other children, and some of the other children had been rabble-rousing, let's say, and, you know, on social media and posting very negative and nasty things about mom. And so we filed a motion to exclude any questions or evidence relating to her relationship with the other children on the grounds that her relationship with other children was not relevant to her relationship with this child, the one that the claim was about. The court granted that. It was not going to allow questions about relationships with her other children. There was like some explicit text messages, teens and text messaging. Probably every case, there's going to be some that you don't want a jury to see, that no one was intended to see other than the sender and the recipient. And we certainly had some of those. So we filed motions on those. And those are some examples of the types of motions we filed.
So important to do that and framing it in that way, because some of these things, if they're not drafted and argued the right way, you could have a judge listen to it and go, well, let the jury decide what's relevant and not relevant. And so what critical, you know, behind the scenes work to make sure that you get the only admissible evidence into the trial. Tell me a little bit about some of the highlights in the case during trial and some of the what you saw as pivotal moments in addition to the Lindsay testimony, which is so effective.
There's one kind of 10,000-pound issue that we dealt with but needed to be dealt with, which is that at the end of the day, and something that hasn't even come up yet 40 minutes into our discussion, is that our client's daughter, Jazzy, died of lymphoma. She died of complications from a lymphoma. She had an undiagnosed cancer that nobody knew about and was never diagnosed until after she passed. And so, again, one of the challenges for the case is, well, this is a girl who died of a rare and undiagnosed cancer. There was no gynecologist or primary care doctor in America that would have looked at this little girl and diagnosed her with this cancer. And so one of the things we had to head off immediately was, what was the impact of the cancer in this case? And Merrill put on a pediatric oncologist early in the case who was able to think definitively address that issue so that it never raised its head again. And the basic issue was that she had a cancer that had about a 90% cure rate if it's treated. She died of complications from it, which was essentially just fluid in her chest. That's also easily treatable just by draining the fluid. And then they would have treated the cancer, and there was a 90% chance she would have survived from it. The defense didn't even have a competing oncologist to refute that, because it's not really refutable. And so, again, the defense wanted to make this, no one could expect us to diagnose a rare childhood cancer case. We never talked about cancer, really. I mean, Merrill did the opening, and she didn't mention cancer until the last 5 minutes of it. And it was only as an aside that after she was died, they happened to diagnose cancer. But you'll hear in this case that that has nothing to do with anything, because there's a 90% cure rate. And if she had just been treated for the complications, she'd still be alive right now. And that didn't continue to haunt us more throughout the case. So that was kind of one big issue that we knew we had to deal with. And I think we did deal with it very effectively. In terms of the big turning points at trial, I cross-examined the defendant gynecologist. You know, you're always concerned about those exams because generally in medical malpractice cases, you know, many times the doctors are actually really nice people. They're good humans. They are devoting their careers and lives to health and healing of people. They care about people. And especially when you're dealing with obstetrics and gynecology, these are doctors who deal with, you know, deliver babies. And for the most part, they're good, nice, well-meaning people. And Dr. Salhini presented the picture of a very nice person. You know, if you met her out at a cocktail party or something, you'd probably really like her. And so we knew we'd have to deal with that. Her cross-examination, I think, went better for us than we would have expected, because instead of coming across as that sympathetic, nice gynecologist, she was fairly defensive and fairly argumentative. And I think that really was a like emotional turning point, that she didn't garner probably a lot of goodwill in a lot of her answers. There were two that were particularly memorable. One was, I guess three. One was where she said, you know, despite asking for the medical records, I didn't really need them anyway. There was nothing there that I needed, and that just didn't make any sense. The second one was when we asked her about, you know, well, you guys didn't take any vitamins. And this is a girl, 15-year-old with pneumonia and all of these constellation of symptoms that you had admitted you've never seen in your entire career practicing medicine. So highly unusual presentation, and you don't do any vital signs except for a blood pressure, you know, no respiratory rate, no heart rate, no oxygen saturation. She was hypoxic at the last visit, so forth. And she said, well, we don't really do vital signs in obstetrics and gynecology. And when our expert, Harvard-educated, Yale-resident gynecologist from Connecticut was on, and I asked her, you know, is it true that gynecologists don't do vital signs? She's like, no, of course not. That's crazy. I mean, we're dealing with pregnant women. That's a central part of what we do. And everybody on the jury, when she said we don't do vital signs, you could see them shaking their head like, that's crazy. Like, of course you do vital signs. So there's that. And then another part of her exam, kind of at the end, after her redirect, where she basically doubled down on her approach to this, when I got back up and did my recross, I said, basically what you're saying, doctor, is if you had this 15-year-old girl with this constellation of highly unusual breast symptoms, engorged blood vessels with an underlying pneumonia, if you had her in your office again today, because you believe what you did was correct, you'd do exactly the same thing today as you did then, right? And she said, yeah, I would.
Oh my gosh.
And again, that was kind of a mic drop moment. I mean, you could just feel like that's really kind of crazy. So those were two parts. And then maybe the one that really took the cake is the defense expert. And this is we could do a whole podcast on this one, but.
Just one question on the doctor herself before we go to that. I was just curious, was the direct examination of the gynecologist, did she present really nice and friendly and somebody that you'd say was likable and then changed personalities on cross, or was her tenor the same from minute one?
So we called her as part of our case in chief. So I crossed her before they did their direct.
Got it.
And we covered most of the territory. So I let her talk a lot because I didn't think it was necessarily helping her cause. And she was quite argumentative and defensive and more or less made all the points that I think her lawyer had intended or coached her to make on direct. So there wasn't that much for, I mean, they went plowed that ground a second time, but it was hard for her to change her affect at that point. And I think she was pretty consistent on the redirect and then throughout, really. So do we want to talk about their expert, Meryl? This was just a real gift.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, before I go on to that, I just want to add one comment to the points Ben's just discussed about his brilliant cross-examination of the gynecologist, because first of all, I completely agree with all three of the turning points or key points that Ben has just identified in that testimony, especially his point about her testimony that we don't take extensive sets of vital signs. We don't take full sets of vital signs in a gynecology practice. We had a 10-person jury and we had three women on the jury, which we thought probably wasn't great for us initially, but the 4-person was a woman. And I remember she was sitting on the lower level closest to the bench. And when the gynecologist said, we don't do vital signs in a gynecology practice, our very stoic, very, very, very stoic jury, especially this 4-person, I mean, she just really didn't bat an eye throughout the trial. She would always turn and pay attention, but her face was very stoic. When that comment was made, I saw her furrow her brow, like, and I thought, oh, that's good. But I completely agree with what Ben said. But let's talk about definitely the most entertaining piece of the whole trial was Ben's cross-examination of the defense standard of care expert. So they're expert on what a reasonable, competent gynecologist would do under these circumstances. She, how do I characterize her? She, first of all, was not practicing gynecology by the time she got involved as an expert in the case. Ben will have to talk more about all the various ways in which he impeached her credibility, not the least of which was his effort to go through her masterclass materials that she has advertised online. So she was not practicing medicine. She was working full-time as an expert and had created this masterclass for other physicians who are interested in becoming experts, particularly gynecologists who are interested in becoming medical legal experts, to take for $7,500, which included...
Which we had to buy, by the way.
Right, which we bought because we just knew it was going to be worth it. And boy, were we right. This was another moment where our very stoic jury showed signs of life. One of the things Ben brought up in his cross-examination of this expert was a video advertising her masterclass where there's cash raining down from the sky, and she is talking about how much money you can make as a medical expert and how much more money you can make and how many fewer hours you can work working as an expert witness than you can as a physician. And it was, I saw a young man who was sitting in the front row, juror, watching it go like this.
Oh my goodness.
You'll have to watch the YouTube video to see Meryl's expression.
Wide eyes and a little smirk like, oh boy. He was embarrassed for her, I think. But it was really brilliant, I think. She, of course, became very worked up, very defensive, arguing with every little thing. It was a work of art, really, and I wonder about her career as an expert after this trial.
So how long was the cross-examination?
It was probably an hour, maybe a little less.
I think it was in the range of an hour. Yeah, I mean, so Meryl's very kind, I think. There was so much to work with this doctor that we all would have done a phenomenal job crossing her because there was just so much low-hanging fruit. I think one of the challenges I find in when you have somebody that has a lot of vulnerabilities and you can see your openings on cross is you don't want to overplay your hand because you can turn that in. You can make her sympathetic by beating them up too much. And so you want to address things that are demonstrative of their credibility, but you want to do it in a fair way. If you're doing things that are unfair, I think that can come back, you know, against you. So, and I tend to be pretty aggressive in cross, and I think sometimes I can overdo things maybe. And I really wanted to avoid that tendency to turn her into a martyr and to make her sympathetic by, you know, bludgeoning her to death. Probably if you were watching it, you'd think I was pretty aggressive and we did score a lot of points, but it was a muted version of what one could have done with the information. And we had 10 modules from her expert masterclass. Each module was about an hour long of her on video, you know, making representations and statements about how to be an expert. So we were very judicious in the sections that we chose to utilize. The overarching subtext of it, I developed this kind of shtick I've used in closing a few times now, which is it kind of goes to something that I had once done in voir dire of a question in med mal cases, which is something along the lines of, it's trying to address the issue of in every med mal case, or like many trial cases, you know, both sides are going to have experts. And I think one of the challenges you face as a plaintiff, especially in med mal, is a lot of times you have, you know, highly credentialed experts on both sides saying diametric opposite things. And it's very hard for the jury to sort out which one of those to believe. And that never works well for the plaintiff because obviously we have the burden of proof. So the jury can just say, well, I mean, both sides have really good experts, throw up their hands. I don't really know. I can't sort that out. That's a defense verdict. I think a lot of defense verdicts in medical malpractice cases, that's what happens. They just can't sort it out. And so one of the things I had done earlier in voir dire, I don't do in voir dire anymore, but it's, you know, how many of you here think that if you're a doctor and you're getting sued for negligence or malpractice, even if you're guilty of it, even if you did wrong, how many of you think that you're not going to be able to find a doctor somewhere in America, as long as you're willing to pay for their time, to come into court to vouch for you? And nobody believes that. Everyone believes that a doctor is going to be able to find someone to do that for them. Now, how many of you think if you're bringing a case against a doctor and it's a frivolous lawsuit that the doctor did absolutely nothing wrong, that you're going to be able to find a highly qualified doctor, not just any doctor, but a highly qualified doctor from a prestigious institution, Harvard or Yale or something like that, to put their good name and reputation behind that and to come in and support that? And again, very few people think that's ever going to happen. And so we had a case here where we had a highly qualified gynecologist, like I said, Harvard Medical School, did a residency at Yale, is on faculty at Yale, versus somebody who's essentially a professional paid expert who doesn't have any faculty appointments, not published a single article of relevance in the field. Her prior work as a doctor involved approving online purchases for hormone creams for postmenopausal women for a company that wanted to sell expensive creams online, you know. And so I knew that that's where we were heading in the closing. So the cross-examination was designed to draw out that contrast between, you know, who she was and what her credentials were and what our experts' credentials were. And now I do that same shtick that I used to do in the voir dire. I do that in closing. Now I do it as, you know, let's do a thought experiment here. Because I know from doing it in voir dire, I know what people are thinking about it already. How many of you think, you know, you're going to be able to find a doctor who's going to find another doctor who's willing to come in? And how many of you think that a plaintiff with a frivolous case is going to find someone like this doctor, Donaldson Ramos, with Harvard and Yale educated and so forth? And then make the point that it's not just having an expert, it's who that expert is and their credibility that they bring to the table.
Did you do a little extra lathering on that when talking about the defense expert being basically a true advocate and she would come in and say anything?
Yeah, no, we layered that up quite a bit. I mean, we had the still shot from the video that Meryl described of her
with the money
raining down over her. And actually in the video, there's a cha-ching, cha-ching. And then you see like the big numbers flashing on the screen, 1,000, 1,500 like per hour or something. And, you know, it just, that visual says all you need to know about this person, really. So we had set that up. But then in closing, we had that slide. We actually had it blown up on a big poster board and we elected not to use that because we thought that maybe was over the top. So we showed the slide. But we didn't use the poster board. In fact, the poster board is sitting here in my office. One of our staff members posted somebody else's image on the poster board and left it in my office for me as a joke.
Amazing. So tell me a little bit about the defense close briefly and then how you dealt with what you anticipated it to be. Did they live up to your expectations? And then how did your rebuttal go?
I'm trying to think through the defense close. The defense lawyer, I thought, came pretty hard at some of the points been made during our closing, but it was more or less what we had expected him to argue, which was continually pointing out the primary care provider's involvement. I do remember, and I think this was something we could have expected, that he was going to take the phone calls that we had played during Mom's testimony and use those calls to remind the jury and to point out what the primary care provider was not doing. He did take advantage of that, and he did use that as part of his closing, was to say, folks, you heard the calls. Each one of those calls was with the primary care provider. None of them were with Midcoast or the gynecology practice. He made arguments about how it was just once, we just saw her once, which we fully expected. And he did something interesting on the damages point, which was, I think he was, you know, trying to do his job by saying, if the jury reached the question of damages, making a suggestion to them about what they award, and which I thought was interesting. And he suggested to them that if they reached the question of damages, that they only ought to award $1 million. You know, it's hard to know whether that had any effect, but we thought that was pretty interesting because why would you make that suggestion at all? His closing was more or less, I think, what we had expected largely.
So then how much time did you spend on rebuttal and what points did you want to hit home with the jury?
I had a very short rebuttal. I covered most of it in the principal close, but we had developed a theme for the case called unserious medical care. And we liked the term unserious because it fit the case well. And it's kind of a memorable term. Like, it's not a word people use much. But in the opening, Meryl, we had the theme was unserious medical care. It was unusual. If you do a lot of Med-Mal cases, you'll appreciate this. Usually the unusual presentation is something the defense tries to use in every case. Well, how could we have known, you know, X, this was unusual. They love the word unusual. They do use that all the time. And here, you know, unusual childhood cancer, no one could have anticipated. So we decided we're just going to commandeer the term unusual. because the gynecologist had admitted she had never seen an adolescent girl with this constellation of symptoms ever in her entire career. So we thought, oh, unusual kind of fits here, right? So I think people think, well, if someone comes in with a really unusual set of circumstances, you ought to look into it pretty carefully, especially if it can be concerning or life-threatening, right? It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card, although the defense likes to think it is. So our theme in the opening was unusual patient, unserious medicine, unimaginable harm. And in closing, in rebuttal, after they did their whole dog and pony show in their closing, I came back with unserious medical care. And now we've seen an unserious defense, an unserious expert, and an unserious defense. You know, their defense basically failed to address the serious indictment of the care and the critical issues that were really involved here. And they were changing the picture, distracting, distorting, using unserious experts, unserious arguments, and so forth. So I think my rebuttal was maybe 7 minutes, and it was that thing. I got up and I just wrote unserious care, unserious expert, unserious defense.
One of the things Ben said in his actual closing, but that he said when he did one of his practices of his closing arguments to our firm when we were practicing it internally, he characterized the gynecologist's negligence as a failure to just have basic curiosity, like just not even basic curiosity about what was going on with this teenage girl with a set of symptoms she'd never seen before in her career. I thought that just really hit the nail on the head for the whole case. I mean, you talk about simplifying medical concepts, simplifying standard of care, simplifying the negligence. That was it right there, is a failure to have even basic curiosity. And that was, I thought that was a way of characterizing it that was very accurate and very even-handed. So I think was effective.
I'll tell you that I am not a medical malpractice lawyer. I've heard so many medical malpractice cases and examples throughout our podcast here. And the way that you framed this case from start to finish truly resonated with me. I get it. You know, I got it just from Merrill when you first started with the facts all the way through the end. It's just like, this just should not have happened. And it seems so easily preventable, not just do your job perfectly, just do something. And that's amazing. So how long did the jury deliberate and what was the verdict?
The deliberation process was interesting. So the jury began their deliberations around 4 o'clock. And the courthouse that we were in closed at 4 o'clock. But what the judge told us was that he was going to keep the jury for an hour to see if they could make any progress and keep some very basic staff around to accommodate that. And then he was going to check in with them at 5 p.m. So we waited for an hour. And right before 5 o'clock, we were told the jury had a note. And we went in and we found out that the jury's note was something to the effect of, in considering damages, is there any precedent that we can look to? So we thought, oh, gosh, great. They're on the damages question, that we're thrilled, right? And the judge's answer to the question was nothing other than the evidence in my instructions, of course. So from there, the marshal kind of said, well, we're going to keep them a little longer just to see what happens, since it sounds like they've made some progress. And I'd say 20, 25 minutes later, there was a verdict. In Maine, the way the reading of the verdict, the taking of the verdict occurs is that the jury is brought in. They hand their verdict form to the marshal, who then hands it to the judge, who takes a look at it to make sure it's complete and accurate, who then hands it to the clerk to read into the record. And as it was being read, yes on negligence, yes on causation, which we weren't surprised to hear based upon the note. And so then the question about damages came, and there were 2 lines on the verdict form for the jury to award damages. The first line was, what do you award to Lindsay Sutherland, to Mom, for her loss of consortium for the wrongful death of Jazzy Vincent? And then the second line was, what do you award for the conscious pre-death pain and suffering, Jazzy Vincent? So under Maine law, the question number one, the death claim, that belongs to the estate, to mom and to beneficiaries for their loss of comfort, consortium, society, companionship of the decedent. The second line, though, that claim belongs to the decedent for the suffering that the decedent endured prior to their death as a result of the negligence. The jury awarded $10 million on the loss of consortium, the wrongful death claim, and $15 million for the child's pre-death pain and suffering, which, I mean, it made history. It was unbelievable.
Amazing and so well-deserved, and that is true justice. So congratulations to you both for representing your client to the best level humanly possible.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rahul.
No, thank you. And thank you for sharing all of this with our listeners. It's amazing. I mean, I was taking notes during it because there's just so many effective tools that you used to communicate the right message and to cut through all of the noise that you know the defense was going to make and cut them off at the knees so they couldn't do that and even just prevent them from doing it in the first place. So excellent, excellent job. And thank you.
Thanks, Meryl.
Thank you, Rahul. Thanks, guys.
Did we rise to the challenge today? If so, tell a friend. If not, tell us what would make the podcast more valuable to you. Thanks for spending your valuable time with us today. And remember, when we elevate people and we elevate practices, we elevate the profession. Produced and powered by LawPods.